It is Saturday, September 15th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, we'll be covering some interesting geek news, and in the second half, we'll invite you to call us about questions of technology, questions or comments about technology. The phone number is 800-655-5877, and I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about 25 minutes. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the room with me is Stacey Juergens. She's an educator and geek, gaming geek. Hi, Stacey.
Hello.
And we also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben is a web developer, web instructor, and a world traveler. Let's go for it today.
Sure. How's it going?
Good. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
And of course, Miles Cullum-Elam, software engineer and political junkie. More Miles.
Good morning.
Miles, I'm going to start with you for the news.
So what I would like you to do is check your phone bill.
Right now?
Yes, right now, because you're probably being overcharged. What they were finding was people were being overcharged for data that's actually the wrong word, but the count of the amount of data that you use on your smartphone is off by about 5 to 7% on average.
Interesting. How would a person know how much data they've used on their smartphone versus what the phone company's telling them?
That's the tricky thing, is that there's a researcher by the name of Chunyi Peng, who is a UCLA professor, mm-hmm. who was checking to see what happens, especially if you're on roaming, where your phone sends out information. And the way TCP/IP works is you send out a packet, then there's an acknowledgement the packet was received, the signal and the acknowledgement, SYNAC, and it's an important part to know whether or not your packet was received.
Yeah.
However, he found if you send packets, even if they're not received, it still shows up on your tally.
The receipt. Oh, I see what you're saying.
So
the transaction doesn't actually, it fails.
Right.
That small bit of traffic fails and you have to reattempt that. But the traffic that was that fail still.
Okay. Imagine you have a flashlight and you are sending Morse code to another person.
And the other person would be the phone carrier's receiver, right?
Well, no. The other person is the person on the other end of the line.
Okay.
So whoever you're sending email to or whatever, something like that. And so you flash and the other person flashes back or just like can see your flashes. Now let's say that something gets in the way. I don't know, cloud rolls in, a fog rolls in, or you know, some ship comes by.
Something that you don't control.
Go right. On. But the phone company is still charging you for the flashes you are making with your flashlight, even though the other end never sees it.
Okay, so I get the idea, but the question I've got for you, Miles, is if the phone company's responsibility is just to make sure that your cell phone has access to the internet at large, some node on the internet, and they achieve that and send that packet to the internet, and then at that point it gets lost, is that really their responsibility or is it your responsibility?
But this is what we're talking about. We're talking about data roaming where if you're sending packets and they're not being received, you're not on the internet.
Well, that's not just so true. If you get to the internet and then the packets get lost on the internet, that's still a possibility.
But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about your phone trying to contact the tower, like you're in an elevator.
Well, that's the thing, is if your phone is attempting to contact the tower and they're counting that, that's a fail. That's their fault, right? But if your phone is trying to connect, it connects to the tower, and then after that, you don't get the transaction doesn't occur. That's not necessarily the phone company's responsibility.
We can get into arguments about quality of service or not, but we're talking about something that is, if you are in an area that is not as well served.
Gotcha. So we are talking about the failure occurring between the phone and the cell tower, which of course is what we're paying for and of course should be the thing that gets counted.
Right. So he tried up some extreme circumstances, and in one area he sent 450 megabytes of data that were never received, and that showed up on the tally.
Interesting. So how do you fight this with a phone company? You just call and say, hey, give me some more money?
Well, there's another wrinkle to this, which is DNS requests are not counted to your quota. DNS request being that ability to change www.google.com to an IP address.
Right.
In other words, looking up the internet phone number.
So that's free?
That is free. And so it is, in fact, possible, if you have certain applications, to tunnel packet data through port 53, which is DNS.
And get free.
Right. And so he was able to transfer 200 megabytes of data without any tally to it.
Of course, that would be on a phone that could support that. We'd have to, you have to change the software on the phone to do that, or
well, you
an app.
Yeah, put an app on it.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, the DNS backbone, there's some great sci-fi about using that as like a video server as a potential, right? Because the protocol is so ubiquitous, and it's possible to transfer more data through it. And normally it's kind of that free service because, well, normally doesn't that much traffic and it's such an essential part of it. Additionally, of course, the phone company is going to cache almost all the DNS entries. So it's not like you're going outside the phone company when you ask for a DNS record.
Right.
In any case, so.
And just to be clear, when you were talking about if the internet doesn't get your packet, that's not the carrier's concern. You're right. If it's in terms of, for example, when people try to get to our website and something isn't working right, that's a different issue. It's
right.
Talking about...
And that's the thing that's interesting, yeah, is that...
All things being equal, hard, except for your connection to
right.
the cell tower.
They really need to be talking... Yeah, as long as they're providing that service. They're saying, I'm going to connect your phone, I'm going to charge you for the amount of traffic you use, to the internet. At that point, it's not our responsibility, right? If you want to spend your time watching videos of cats licking themselves, that's your deal. If you want to go to a site that doesn't work very well, that never responds, that's your fault. I mean, I get that aspect. Mm-hmm. But if they're losing it before it goes there, and that's their fault and their service, there's no way they should be charging for that. It's ridiculous.
Right. Now, bear in mind, though, we're talking about, like, carriers will charge, like, $15 per gigabyte that you go over. The numbers that he was talking about were, like, 450 and 200. And so we're talking about a little less than half or one-fifth of a gigabyte. Right.
The thing that's interesting about this is
so I don't know that the numbers are really as serious, but at the same time, the phenomenon is something that bears watching, especially as we start going to 4G.
From my understanding, the Send ACK part of TCP/IP is so essential to the protocol that if you that you need to get fails back to slow down the traffic load. Like, if you and I are communicating through TCP/IP, Miles, if I'm talking too fast, you start giving responses of earlier parts of my conversation, I know to repeat myself. If you never do that, and you keep, then the connection between us can get filled, the buffers can get filled, and we have this problem where you're actually getting data that's really old. So that I've lost data and pass it through the pipeline and tell me when I've failed is part of the protocol.
There's the funny thing, though, is that even though TCP/IP is what the applications on your smartphone are running, and even that's what the internet is running on,
That's not the
protocol that's going on with regard to edge technology or 3G or 4G LTE.
Right. When it comes down to it, it's radio signals and it's analog, therefore, and so you're analyzing it.
Right. Essentially, there's like a dual TCP stack going on. One of them is happening at your phone level, and one of them is happening at the carrier's cell tower or at their central office, more likely.
All right. Thank you, Miles. Stacey, hey.
Hi. So I wanted to talk about the Renaissance Pleasure Fair that's happening in, Northern California, technically in Gilroy.
Are you going?
I am, in fact. I'm going tomorrow.
Great.
I have a bunch of friends that work at the Ren Fair, but geeks and Ren Fair kind of go hand in hand.
Absolutely.
They definitely overlap quite a bit. And this particular Ren Fair is happening, it's opening today, and it's going through October 14th. So it's going to be every Saturday and Sunday through October 14th. And there's going to be lots of games and...
Describe what a Ren Fair is.
Yeah, I've actually never been to one.
Yeah.
What? Get out of this room right now.
I have never...
Are you going tomorrow?
And you call yourself a geek.
Stacey, can I come to Ren Fair with you tomorrow?
Yeah, I think you really should.
All right, awesome.
There you go.
Oh my God, it's already in my calendar. That's weird.
How convenient.
But yeah, but I mean, up until tomorrow, I have never been to a Ren Fair.
Ben, what do you think Ren Fair is?
Oh gosh, I have no idea.
Come on, make a guess.
It's a bunch of jousting and beer and... I don't know.
It's
medieval
people
speak,
don't know.
Ye old. Uh-huh. I have no
and
idea.
Don't forget the embellishment of certain attributes with clothing.
Of course. Okay. Costumes.
Bodices.
Bodices.
So there you go.
I was thinking
you don't have
of
to go
codpieces,
now.
But that's
okay. course you were, Miles.
Autism are far more prevalent, I must say.
Yeah. Well, that's what you think. But go on.
Well, there is jousting and there is beer.
You don't have to joust if you go, though, right?
Actually, I don't believe that you can unless you're one of the actors that on the horses.
I like the way Ben's head works on his body.
What are you talking about?
I know, like jousting, you get your head removed.
Yeah, what happens if you just show up with a horse? You'd be like, hey.
let's bring it on.
I got a horse and I got a phone pole.
Wait, so there are actors
not everyone gets the joust, is
what
we're saying.
Do fake fighting? Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's kind of like medieval times in that regard. There's they do have a horse arena where they'll have the jousting and the red team and the green team and all those sorts of things. Although I'm not entirely clear what colors they're using or all those sorts of things. But there's definitely the good guys and the bad guys, and your audience gets to cheer for whichever team.
It's kind of like medieval WWE.
Medieval WWE. Oh my god.
That's wrestling, by the way.
It actually, in a way, yeah.
Okay,
it's like acting. Yeah,
all right, so I'm really looking forward, Ben.
Terrifying.
I need you to report what your experience with Renfrew is, because most of the people I know that have gone multiple times and acted in it, performed, all had a great time. So I'm curious, now at your senior levels of age as a geek, whether you're going to like it or not. So go on, say, so you've been multiple times.
I have been multiple times in multiple states.
And are you involved in a camp?
States of inebriation.
No, actually. But I've been in Arizona and California, the Southern Fair in the LA area, and Northern Fair, which is in the Gilroy area. I've been to, it's lots of fun. But they have lots of entertainment. There's game booths, shoot a crossbow, shoot a pistol. They have a marketplace, which is very much, the general idea is to make it look like the reign of Queen Elizabeth I of England. So that's the, let me look up the years here. She was there from 1558 through 1603. And so the general idea is to make the whole setup look like that era. And so there's a marketplace with like these little roads, and there's shops on either side with artisans, food, all sorts of things. And the general idea is all of the staff that works there, the actors, the store owners, all of those sorts of things, they're all encouraged to be as authentic as possible to that era. So all of their clothing, the way that they speak, the way that they interact, and they do some really funny things to try and make it appropriate for modern times. For example, they will call it Master Visa and Miss Visa, Miss Visa and MasterCard, I think. so they're trying to kind of talk about the magic of the plastic that, for payment and things like that.
So they try and
make it as authentic as possible, given that it's modern times.
They were using credit cards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people have dentistry and people wearing glasses.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they have lots of actors and comedians, like the Mooney and Brune show is really, really awesome.
So Ben's gonna have a great time.
Yes.
And it's actually opening today, mm-hmm. and it's at Casa de Fruta, uh-huh. and it's a 2-for-1 weekend this weekend, and next weekend though is Pirate Invasion. So why are you not going next weekend when Pirates?
Oh no,
we could go next weekend.
You could
also
go every weekend.
In fact, you're welcome
to come back here and do the show next week too. All right. So that's the Renaissance Fair. You can learn more from geekspeak.org. We'll have it up after the show
is
over.
That's for a month.
And it's for a month, and you can do every weekend if you want. And there's themes. And, of course, on there, if you want the 2-for-1 thing, you got to get a coupon from their site. But you can get to that from geekspeak.org in just, 20 minutes or so. Ben, thank you, Stacey.
And fun fact,
yeah.
Our own Southern California geek correspondent, Alex Leas, worked at a Ren Fair.
Of course. Who hasn't? I've done it.
Awesome. I haven't.
Well, that's true. You've never
Apparently,
even been.
Apparently, I'm the only person who has never worked or gone
I worked the fencing booth last year.
You worked the fencing booth. Oh, I did fencing once. I was really bad at it.
I believe that. I mean, that's interesting. Let's move on. Ben, you're very good at bringing up geek news, so do so.
Hey, I got some for you. Do you guys know what a standing wave is?
Kind of. It's a wave that actually resonates with itself and therefore is stable.
Resonates with itself or more frequently resonates with another wave. So you have two waves that are interfering with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get an interference pattern, or if you're talking about a fluid or something, If you've ever seen like a vibrating body of water, you might see these lumps in the water that stay up high or down low, you know, and they kind of, or they might oscillate a little bit. That's a standing wave. Also, if anyone plays guitar and you play a harmonic, you can actually get the string to vibrate with multiple different nodes. Well, in any case, what they've actually done for Argonne Labs for NASA to simulate microgravity conditions for very, very small objects, especially liquids, they've created an acoustic levitation setup. So what you can actually do is you take one speaker, you point it up, you take another speaker and you point it down at the other speaker. So they're pointing right at each other. And you play a relatively high frequency. They're playing about 22 kilohertz, like a 22 kilohertz sine wave.
That's higher than we can hear.
That's just a bit higher than the youngest of us can hear. So just above the audible range. And when they do that, they actually create a standing wave pattern in the air. Now, you can't see it because it's air. But it turns out if you put a little bit of water or some kind of droplet of a liquid in one of the nodes of this standing wave, it'll actually float. It'll actually just kind of hover there on this buffer of air.
How small a node?
Wait a second. And also, if this is done in L.A., can you see it?
In L.A.?
Yeah. Because the Los air, Angeles. You can see the air in L.A.
That's true. So Miles and I are glad we don't live down there anymore.
Yeah.
So I think it's what you're trying to say, especially with children. So how big of a droplet of air? We're talking really, really small?
Droplet of water. We're talking about something that you would use a syringe to...
You can see it with the naked eye, though, the droplet
of
water.
If you were to splash some water on the desk and you'd have maybe a medium-sized droplet on the desk, we're talking about that amount
of
water, right?
Wow.
It's actually a decent amount of water.
Is the standing wave coming from two different... The two sources coming from two different locations?
Two different locations.
This is similar to how they use lasers for tweezers at nanoscales, right?
Very much.
So
they use the lasers to heat up the air to move the air, right?
They create standing. I mean, we're talking about nanoparticle levels. You actually take a standing wave of two light beams, and you can actually trap stuff in it.
Incredibly amazing things with standing waves and with wave interference patterns. Like one other thing that you can do is. This is just one of the coolest pieces of tech, I think. If you want to take sound and direct it in a beam, well, normally if you have maybe the sound or something like that, it's too low to direct, right? If you have the lower the frequency is, the less directional it is. But what you can actually do is you can take really expensive and very precise speakers. And you can play two incredibly high pitches and use those two high pitches and have them interfere with each other to create that original pitch, the lower pitch you wanted. And the pitch that you wanted is not actually just being created by the speakers. It's being created by the interference pattern between the two sounds, I guess, that you're projecting. And that allows you to create that low sound and point it in a direction. Because you're actually using high frequency, high frequencies, and high frequencies are incredibly directional. It's a really cool piece of tech.
Very cool.
You guys use it for denim, right?
We do.
For
we have at my work. We have some speakers that are like that, so you can hang a speaker above an audience location, and as audience members walk into that beam of sound, they can hear it. If you walk away from it, you can't. It's really cool.
It's really
surreal. Like it's in your head.
Yeah. But anyway, this is pretty cool tech. Microgravity water droplet.
And you can learn more about it and everything we say up at geekspeak.org at the end of the show. You have one more thing?
Just one more thing. I really was hoping that when I read this, at first I thought, oh God, well, what if you just get much bigger speakers and then you put yourself inside of the node?
Yes.
I mean, aside from the fact that it would take a ridiculous amount of energy to levitate you, it would also probably, the forces would probably tear your body apart.
You'd probably be spinning really fast too. It'd be just a horrible experience.
It'd be so cool to just, you know, like
what
hop
about a baby?
Up on this cushion.
Because babies are smaller.
A baby?
Yes, and they're not fragile at all.
No?
Okay. No, not at all.
Speaking of babies, you've got a baby. What's your news story, Miles? Or is it your turn? I don't know. I'm doing this.
That was an incredible. You know,
I was teaching, my God. That was the worst segue ever.
I was teaching all last week, right? And I did one of those for between people. And people were like, I could feel the room go. That was awkward. I said, you know, I do radio sometimes. And that's why I did that. I'm sorry.
Because on radio, it's less awkward?
This is expected?
It's expected.
So as web developers, we all hate Internet Explorer.
Oh, yeah.
With a passion.
I mean, I wake up in the morning and I have this pillow that says IE on it. I just punch it repeatedly.
Yeah.
No. That's my stress relief too, yeah.
Yeah. For those of us who have to support, for example, IE 7 or IE 6.
Internet Explorer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very much this idea of, okay, I'm going to make a website and then I'm going to spend just as much time, if not more, to make sure it also works in this one other browser.
Mm-hmm. A very painful process.
Yes.
Wait, are all four of us web developers?
Maybe.
Yeah. We all are.
Web developers on the radio.
Right. This is not just just for the non-web developing audience out there, this is not just about us saying, oh, we want the new technology. We want to be able to use that. This is painful.
Yeah.
We want to be able to say, you want Internet Explorer 7 support? Well, we're going to charge you twice as much. But that doesn't really go over well with most people, even though it's twice as much effort. Yeah. It's redevelopment.
You redevelop
And the reason we say this, of course, is if you take all the other browsers, you can do kind of one thing for them. And then you have to do something different for Internet Explorer. It's not like it's the same amount of work for you have to, you know, it's 50% of the time with Firefox and 50% of the time with Safari. And then it's not like
it's
that.
Just, it's right. Just
you do
it's,
one development, it works for everybody
yeah,
except
it's like,
for IE.
Yeah, it's like 98%.
Compliance across all
compliance,
those
compliance, and then you do the last 2% is to make sure that it works in Chrome, Firefox, and
Right. Little tiny details.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with Internet Explorer, everything just breaks horribly, and unfortunately, it's like 30 or 40% of the population uses it. Right.
Yes.
So it's a kind of important.
No, not anymore.
Okay.
But it's a lot of large corporations mm-hmm. still use it.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
So that's an area where if you're doing business and you have a deal with a large business. You can't get out of it. Like it's like, oh, well, you're going to support our 4,000 seats or you don't get the contract.
Right.
You know.
Okay, so what are
the reason why I bring this up is because Google has been very aggressive at dropping previous versions of Internet Explorer in the past. For example, they made headlines not too long ago in that they were dropping Internet Explorer 7.
For their apps like Gmail. Not for Google searching.
I mean. Yeah, for Gmail, for Google Docs.
Calendars, like things like that.
And 2 years ago, they dropped IE 6. And there was a web development firm in Denver that had a funeral for IE6 browser to be buried without the body. It was amazing.
And so it's really big news that they say they're going to drop Internet Explorer 8 come November of this year.
Is there a newer browser than 8 right now?
Yes, there's 9.
Okay.
Except 9 can't be used on XP, which is the whole wrinkle.
So what you're saying is you can't. So pretty soon you won't be able to use Google on XP unless you use a browser. Like all the other any other browser.
Right. Unless you download a different browser than Internet Explorer, you cannot use Google Apps on Windows XP come November.
All right.
Because that is when Internet Explorer 10 will be released. And Google's policy now is they're going to support a browser for the most recent version and one revision back. And so two revisions back, it's dropped
off. Chrome is released every day. They have, like, they're up to, like, 97 on their releases.
Except...
So are they only released, they're going to only support the last two?
Yes.
You can only use Chrome if it was made last week.
Well, that's the thing, though, is that almost all users are on the newest
most recent,
version of Chrome.
Because it automatically updates.
Right. And it is now the case with Firefox.
Yeah.
And so the only ones that are holding us back are the ones that take twice the development time to get working.
So is Google then on Gmail, if you log in with Internet Explorer 7, does it give a message saying you can't use this? Or does it just silently backwards?
No, says that it is not supported on your browser. Please download one of these others.
Because one of the things that's always frustrating, of course, as a web developer, normally what the customer wants us to do is develop a site that works for Internet Explorer 4. Or whatever, right?
Not that far back.
And
yeah.
If you can't do the features, you degrade it in a way that's still usable. So it's this extra time to say, well, if you don't have a hover effect and you can't do this, what do you do now? So the thing is, if instead they just said, you know, your experience is horrible because your browser is so old, and that started showing up everywhere, that would let people upgrade their browser. They'd start.
Right. The difference that's happening now is that there are many features that are just you just can't emulate them. Without a huge effort, and then it's still not as good.
Right.
So you have things like cross-domain AJAX. What that means
is... And everybody
is,
needs that.
Right. Well, you go to a site, and you want to get data from some other site. Like, say, for example, you're on some company site, and they're getting Google Map data. That would be a common source, because they're getting the data about the maps from Google, which is a different site.
Right.
And you need to have different security protocols for that. Internet Explorer 8 and 9, for that matter, have a limited way of doing it. But Internet Explorer 7 and before are completely in the dark.
You could instantiate a COM object and start doing
Well, if you instantiate a Flash object, in a Flash plugin, do like all sorts of weird black magic.
And so, for example, that's a perfect example, the map. So let's say you've got a website, you're providing all these features to the user. One of them is a way to show where the company is. You know, it's a flower retailer, and it's a great website with lots of pictures of flowers, and also you can order stuff. And you go to this one page and it says, this is where we are to pick up your flowers if you want to pick up. And in every other browser, the map is there. And Internet Explorer, whatever version that doesn't actually function, that the person hasn't supported. Normally what we do is we have like a still image of the map there, which took us extra time to generate. And when you click on it, you then go to Google Maps, which then says, your browser doesn't work. But the point is that instead, the idea of just saying right off the bat, you know, on that page, your browser's not very good. The florist doesn't really care what the browser is, right? The florist just wants it to work. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that Google, as a service provider, is just saying, we're not going to support these services anymore. That should push people more and make the responsibility and the onus on the individuals that are running the older browser rather than the florist shop making websites.
Because I'm sure they're going to sites right now where the Google map does show up in that older browser embedded on that page.
There was a lot
of
time.
So if it works right now, why did we have to do that?
There was a lot of time and effort involved in doing that.
Well, there's a lot of time and effort, and they're also using a technique known as JSONP.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go into the details of that, but let it suffice to say that using that rather than a cross-domain AJAX opens you up to so many security holes, especially a group called cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, that to support this one family of browsers and one group, a subset of a family of browsers, you are making security worse for everyone.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to do more geek news and take calls. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is 88.9 KOSP, KOSP.org. You can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. Learn more at KOSP.org. You're also listening to Geek Speak. Everything we talk about today's show is up at GeekSpeak.org, and you can research it and get excited by it and learn more, including our geek bits, which aren't very good for radio but wonderful for visuals. One of them I want to mention is that recently an eagle who was damaged by probably a poacher, beak was shot off, something like that. The beak was damaged severely. The bird was still alive, but of course, a bird without a beak is not a very good hunter or can't really survive on its own. So what they decided to do is just print a beak for this eagle on a 3D printer. It's the right color and everything, and then I'm assuming epoxy it on. So there's a great little video up at geekspeak.org on how that happens and worked. And the eagle looks just fine now. There's a picture before and after in the video. It's really cool. Anyway, 3D printer. And we've talked about 3D printers, people printing guns, which people can do. You can print guns from
almost
your home.
Almost all the pieces.
Right, almost all the pieces. And then, of course, somebody recently was a titanium jaw was printed, and the jaw was replaced because it had a lot of decay. So there's some pretty amazing stuff going on in the 3D print space.
You can even print a 3D printer using your 3D printer almost all the parts,
right?
Here. Aside from like the motor and things like that.
Geek bits, anybody else?
Yeah, I got a geek bit. So this guy named Bard Canning put together, they took the original Mars Curiosity rover descent video, which was, I think it was 4 frames per second or something. And it's incredible to see that video and to know it's of the descent to an alien world. Well, he took that and he used motion flow interpolation and a whole bunch of motion tracking and some color correction and all this other stuff to create a 30 frames per second HD
nice.
Version of the descent.
Okay,
and it
cool.
is absolutely incredible.
Is that from the lander or from the which craft
it's,
is it from?
It's the rover going all the way down. So you see the
heat from the rover
pop off.
So the rover's perspective.
The rover's perspective. It gets lowered down. It's absolutely incredible.
Thank you, Ben. This is Ben Jaffe. He's a web instructor and world traveler.
I do
Ben,
After Effects
awesome.
Too. And
you
this guy
did a good job.
Did a really, 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 really good job.
All right, you can see the video up at geekspeak.org in just a few minutes.
Absolutely.
And Stacey, you got a. Okay, Stacey Juergens is here as well, and Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. This is Geek Speak. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us anything you'd like. In the air with me is Stacey Juergens, Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. Answering the phone is Rick Philman, and we thank him for the behind-the-scenes service he does for the Central Coast every week. Let's go ahead and do a news story item as we're waiting for a call to get queued up. I think it's your turn, Ben.
It is. I have a quick mention as well that I just want to remind people. Last week, I covered the Space Shuttle Endeavor being flown around the Bay Area and down to Los Angeles. I just want to remind people that's happening on the 20th. And also, there's a story about them cutting down trees in order to make room for the shuttle along the parade route.
Yeah, on I its saw way. That.
Yeah, so I'm going to post that up onto the GeekSpeak site. It's not as geeky of a story, so I'm going to put it on the GeekSpeak site for people to read about. Just because it's happening, if you're around along the flight path on the 20th, check it out and watch the shuttle fly, because it'll be probably the last chance you'll have to see a shuttle in flight. They'll be in museums soon.
Tomorrow here on KOSP, the 7th Avenue Project occurs with Robert Pauly. He welcomes filmmaker Errol Morris back to the show to discuss his investigation of a sensational murder. Morris makes the case that Jeffrey McDonald, an Army doctor serving a life sentence for killing his family, is probably innocent, and his conviction was a gross miscarriage of justice. That's tomorrow, an autonomy of a murder on the next 7th Avenue
Anatomy.
Project. Anatomy of a murder. Hey, thanks, man. We have a call already, so let's go ahead and take it. CB from Felton, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question today, Cindy?
Yeah, I first of all, I really appreciate your show, and I think you guys are fabulous. But I have a question. I've had to shut off my Windows update on this new Windows 7 computer, which I bought at the beginning of the year because my other computer was stolen. And each time I try to update it, and this is in trying to stay updated and all this sort of thing, which is like this never-ending job.
That's true.
With Windows, the computer won't boot up again. It'll just get a blank screen that says directory service not found.
Oh, interesting.
And
so
then
the updates
I have to go to do a save mode startup and go back again and.
Okay. Well, so that's a standard, I mean, that's not a standard thing. That's a really horrible experience, right? You're trying to do exactly what you're supposed to do and your machine won't let you. And so you keep on rolling back to this place where it's probably not very safe. Most likely it's nothing devious going on, but I'm not sure of that. And I'd have to say that you do definitely need to start getting updates again.
I know.
Yeah.
I try every once in a while, but like I said, I never get past that blank screen. It's probably just one update.
What's the
update? And
what's
they always come in large parcels.
Yeah. What's the So one thing to do, the Windows update's kind of the simple way to do it, where you actually use the software package and you tell it to go and get it and download it and run it. You can actually go and get that package and download it and run it yourself, which might be a little bit more stable. But it's not a simple process. In fact, I don't think I've done it for years. Maybe with like Service Pack 2 was the last time I went and downloaded a separate one and carried around on a USB stick. And that was for Windows XP. So we're talking about my experience being pretty lame in this area. Any of you guys have a good experience with this? Stacey, are you running a Windows machine in front of you?
I am, actually.
Okay. And how are you doing updates? You're just doing the auto updates?
It just does it automatically.
Oh, man. So we can't... what we're saying is we just can't help CB.
Well,
our phone numbers are no. So, CV, I think that you should probably take it to a shop, or get a geek in the house that you know to walk through it. Because the thing is, this is the thing that's hard for people to understand about geeks. We don't actually know how to do something. We know how to figure out how to do it, right? So, if I was in your home and spent a bit of time, I'd probably just try to buy you a Mac. But, but I might be able to step through that problem.
The only reason why I have Windows is the cost issue.
Yep.
And the only reason why I bought it online instead of
at a store,
at a local business where I could take it back is because my other computer was stolen and I had to have something fast.
Well, in fairness,
right then and there. And of course, when you buy something online, you get no tech support whatsoever.
Right.
And I bought a Toshiba. And
well, I got to say,
all sorts of problems.
There are some great services in Santa Cruz for this kind of thing, right? There's Dave's Computers down kind of the central of Santa Cruz town. Of course, I just read a promo for the small business IT. Let's see, what's the name of the company?
HASB Tech.
Yeah, HASB Tech, which is the company that actually supports KOSP here. And I've met some of the people. They're really great. And it looks like they do home support. So there's definitely people. You just have to fork down some money, which kind of is a horrible experience when, of course, you bought that machine to try to save money.
The thing is I paid too much for it as it is. I bought it in a panic because my computer
is it a laptop or a desktop machine?
It's a laptop.
So you can move with it. Okay.
It's a better laptop. It's got
I want to mention it's a nice laptop. I want to mention and I hate to do this. I'm going to stick my foot in my mouth, but let me just say that there's a great resource down at Loudoun Nelson Community Center for seniors in computers. And you can bring your machine in and they will probably help you out if you happen to be a senior. So that's just for everybody. It was a lucky guess, and that's me sticking my foot in my mouth and guessing an age of someone. So sorry about that. But in any case, they will support you. And I believe at one point, the senior center at Loudoun Nelson was really awesome about that. It's got a whole bunch of computers there, and there's good support, people kind of volunteering their time. So you might attempt that. At least give them a call and say, can you help me? And they might. And additionally, when you go to a facility for an update, the network speeds are really great normally. Like they've got some pretty good, they've got fiber going to that building from the city, and I think the network speeds in that building are pretty good. So there's my suggestion, CB. I'm sorry I can't help you more directly.
Yeah, but do you have any idea what causes this? Why the update would do this?
Yes,
like
bugs.
Incomplete.
Yeah, bugs in software. I mean, no. I mean, something's going.
So,
yeah, Microsoft did something wrong. It's also the thing that's difficult about this is that you bought your machine from Toshiba, and whatever the company that put the machine together, they used a certain software package and they added add-ons to it. So it's possible that disabling everything and then doing your update might do it. But it can be any little thing that's the problem. So, I mean, if you really wanted to attempt this yourself, try to shut down all applications, including in the taskbar in the bottom right, try to terminate all of them. This is Windows 7, though, and I'm not even sure how to do that. You can slowly start turning off services. But if you really mess up...
Oh, I know how to do that.
Yeah, so you can just start turning... turn off everything you can.
I'm actually running a dual operating system on this because my last computer was a Vista, and I still had XP programs, and I had to run all this stuff somehow.
See, so that dual boot could be part of the problem, that when the Windows update's happening, it's trying to find your master boot record and do the update on that OS, and you've got two OSs on there, and so that's the problem. It's possible. I'm not saying it is, but it's a possibility. If you have your two installs on two different hard drives, which sounds like you don't, if you did, you could unplug
one hard drive.
Yeah, so that complexity of having your dual partition might be the reason you're getting that error. I don't know.
Yeah. I Googled the error message when you said what it was, plus won't boot, and I came up with a Microsoft support document, and it's got, I don't know, 30 steps in it, and it's something I would never want to do myself, but if you felt...
I'll look at it. I'll take a look at it anyway.
Do you want to put that up on geekspeak.org in the show?
If I can find it again,
We will do our best to get that up at geekspeak.org. CB, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
I do have to say that is one of the more frustrating things out there. There's something wrong with my computer. So you have to get on your computer and look up something to figure out how to fix the computer that isn't working.
Right. I love it when you get people, I can't get on the internet. Okay, you want to go to this site? No, you don't understand.
Send us an email that you can't get online.
Yeah, exactly. Send us an email. We'll help you out. But I can't get a... Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, we had this problem the other day.
On behalf of all computer professionals out there, we're sorry.
Yeah, I think we're just going to close the show right there. I'm so sorry. Hey, if you want to share your frustrations with us, please feel free to give us a call. You can also ask us questions about technology in general or give us a comment about the week news we've been chatting about. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. My name is Lyle Trox. We also have Stacy, Miles, and Ben in the air room. And everything we talk about goes up on geekspeak.org. So if you want to learn more about that, just go to geekspeak.org. And of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter someplace. I'm not sure how and where. KOSP and Geekspeak in there,
too,
I think.
We're on Google Plus. We're on
I believe, let's see, I just did your news story last.
I just did a quick mention, but I still got the original news story. But
no, let's move on.
You can give it to Miles, too.
Miles, go ahead.
So let's talk a little bit about BMWs.
The cars?
Yes, the cars.
Right. British driving machine, right?
So, yes. German perfection. Now, since 2006, there's been a feature of BMWs where garages would be able to access the electronic key, as it were, to start the engine and work on the car.
So these cars have an electronic key, and you can... So does that mean there's a remote open, or just when you take your key, you have to have a special key that has a certain circuit in it to get the car
most
to start.
Modern cars have a chip in their key or something like that has a unique ID that only allows it to start your car.
Right, that's why those keys are so expensive. Okay, so garages have been able to start the car without that key?
Right.
Okay.
There's been a feature in BMW since, I think, 2006. And it controls that, that computerization of the car controls the ignition system, mm-hmm. for example. And garages, the certified BMW garages, have had access to this equipment that would be able to go in, change the key around, start up the engine, get it going. But that technology has now found its way onto the black market. And so now some folks are saying that, you know, their BMW is
not there anymore.
Yeah. It's like, wait a second, but I paid a lot for this car. And I made sure I had all the fancy security
features.
And
the last time I lost a key, it cost me $130 to replace the key.
Right.
So there's something supposed to be there that's helping me.
Yeah. And so this coming from the BBC article, quote, you spend £40,000 or £50,000 on a vehicle and someone can come and take your car without a key.
So they're able to unlock it and open it and everything with using this package that supposedly was only supposed to be at registered BMW shops.
Actually, I don't know if he was able to unlock it because when he
can unlock
came
a
to
car
go get
a brick,
his...
So.
Well, the unlock mechanism is not necessarily the same as the ignition key mechanism. So when this particular person came to check on their car, there was a little shattered glass on the floor. So apparently to get into the car, they had to break the glass. But to start the car...
Right. Easy.
They were just
all right,
able
to so just another example of the integrated computer processor in cars being taken advantage of from a bad security model, probably. And the thing is, it's a really tricky thing to do. You know,
and so
you want to have your shop be able to reprogram your car, because if you lose your key, what do you do?
Right. And so now you're seeing on job sites, for example, Ford has a job opening for an API developer.
Yeah. Ford does a lot of work on...
Yeah, but but the idea that someone is...
Yeah.
Not just computerizing the computer, but saying that we want someone that makes a good interface so that A, it's easy to use, and B, doesn't have weird side effects and holes.
It's funny because, you know, the weird side effects on holes on like our websites that we build. Oh, no, the website doesn't work. The weird side effect on the cars. Oh, no, the car's accelerating. I don't want it to. It's a different level of problem.
Oh, the brakes just engaged.
I remember, Miles, you covered a story years ago where the person was doing something with a microcontroller or something, and the bug report they got submitted was, luckily no one died, but, and it was a software problem.
My gosh.
That's a stressful job. I hope the code is right, or someone might die. Yeah, I mean, it's serious business, and of course, the car companies it's just a matter of time before they really have egg on their face. Like now, it's, you know, cars are being stolen. Not the worst case scenario. Cars have always been stolen. It's just a little easier because of a mistake the car company made.
Right, and it doesn't take away all debts or take away all bugs, but it is possible to mathematically prove the algorithm to an algorithm.
That's true.
But the correctness to an algorithm, I should say.
Right.
But at the same time, it takes a lot more effort. It takes a lot more expertise. And a lot more people are in a hurry. I want this software now. I want this feature now. And
right.
That's why it's that give and take. The security and the availability are mutually exclusive in a lot of times.
You know, how do you buy a new car now and know that the software in it is secure? You can't really, right? And there's not like
more
there's
and
a
more
window.
It's looking like you can buy a car and just be assured that it's
not
good.
Security
unless,
isn't good.
unless it's an old, you know, late model car that doesn't have a computer in it. You know?
Yeah. All right, I'm later today potentially buying a 66 Ford truck. No computer in it. I know everything works, and I don't have to guess. It's awesome.
Yeah, I can play with a carburetor, so that
So that I can have hours of joy rebuilding a carburetor. I don't want to do that.
Stacey, your car doesn't have a computer, right?
Absolutely not.
What do you got?
I have a '93 Miata.
You want to sell it? No. Okay, let's move on. All right, Stacey, you're up. Actually, we're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. But since you're not calling it, obviously, all questions have been answered in your life about technology, which is awesome for everybody in the Central Coast of California. If you have mistaken yourself and just realized, oh my gosh, I had a question for them, you're welcome to call us 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting for those calls, it's Stacey's turn, man. I've been doing Miles, Stacey, Ben. Oh, I see.
Do you have any news?
You're good,
Unfortunately, I don't.
All right.
But Ben has a lovely story.
Well, what's his lovely story, Stacey?
Yeah, cover my story for me.
I probably could. I mean, I watched it with you, but...
Yeah, that's true.
Go ahead, one of you.
World's first color moving pictures discovered. So we have thought up until very recently that 1909 was the earliest moving color pictures. But it turns out we were wrong. The National Media Museum in Bradford just found some footage taken by Edward Raymond Turner from London. He patented this color process for creating basically creating moving images in color in 1899, which is that's
did he build it?
He did build it.
Interesting.
He built it. He took a couple shots in 1902, and then he suffered a fatal heart attack. And then people forgot about his stuff for quite a while. I know, bummer, huh?
That does suck.
And one of the biggest issues with his technique is that the projector, it was really tough to get this projector working mechanically. But they
and it gave you heart attacks.
And it gave you, yeah, correlation, causation, maybe. But
it was
any
obviously
case,
a very stressful endeavor getting it working.
Yeah. Right, exactly. But yeah, it's kind of cool. So he took some footage of his children and some footage of
did the footage survive?
Ducks and everything. Yeah, the footage survived and basically was forgotten and hanging out in this old tin.
What does the footage look like?
It looks like old color stuff.
Okay, so it looks like it's film. It's like traditional.
It's like black and white film with some relatively desaturated colors.
So it looks like
colors.
The Wizard of Oz.
And
it looks like the Wizard of Oz.
Was this color process? Do you know if the color process was a chemical color process, or did he
paint
the slides afterwards?
Basically, the way a camera works is you've got the film running by, and then you've got the shutter, and the shutter will stop light coming in so it doesn't hit the film until the next frame comes by, and then it opens and closes. So he added a second shutter, and the second shutter was red, green, blue, red, green, blue. So as this thing spun,
It does a black and white, then it does a red, then it does a blue.
It just does a red, then green, then blue, then red,
the
then green, then blue.
Luminosity is handled by the...
The luminosity is the sum of the three.
Does that mean that, therefore, the project, you have to project with three different colored lights to project it back?
No. Basically, the red, green, and blue images on the film are one after another. So you need to have a projector which can project that specific kind of film. So he tried to build a projector, and it was really, really, really difficult. Of course, these days, all we did basically scanned it into a computer, and we said, okay, every first frame
Apple
is red.
We made a little script in Photoshop and just grabbed all the frames and stacked them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think actually I watched the video. It looks like they were using some kind of node-based compositor like Shake or something.
So Turner
like
made the first color film machine in 1899.
Designed
it in 1899.
He designed it, patented it.
And then 1902 actually did it.
Yes, and if you want to look this guy up, Edward Raymond Turner, because there are a lot of Edward Turners out there, apparently.
You think?
Yeah, I Googled it. I got like a Wikipedia article. Then I added film. I got another Wikipedia article. Not the same guy.
All right.
But kind of cool.
Very. Thank you very much, Ben. From Cupertino, Jerry, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning. I have a real quick question on streaming audio, because I listen to several different stations, both on the East Coast and Southern California, and obviously the North Coast here, because since you shut down your transmitter or your retransmission system on the hill, that I've had to go to the internet. This is going to strike home because KUSP has the most unreliable streaming source that I've come across. I've already had to start the stream, I think, three or four times this morning. It just drops out. It pauses for long periods and then drops out. It pauses for periods and then comes back again. I don't have the problem with KUSC in Southern California. I don't have the problem with WGBH in Boston. I don't have the problem with
you see, there's so much demand when we come on that it just overloads our system.
You guys are splendid. It drives me crazy.
Are you sure it's not just the way that you hear things? I'm sorry, that was me. No, I get this complaint every once in a while. I don't know what level it occurs for everybody or whether it's just certain software. Every time I've gotten that complaint when I'm at the station, I check, everything's fine. Of course, I'm checking at the station because I've answered the phone there.
So I've experienced it before.
I can definitely communicate this to the people that are in charge of our system all the way through. I know everybody. So I'll mention this today and see what happens. I think there's a staff meeting this week, and I'll talk to KSP about it and see what happens. Thank you, Jerry, for the call.
I can restart the audio player, whatever it is that I think it's Windows Media Player, actually.
Oh, no, yeah. Don't do that.
Whatever it is that is running.
It's interesting. I kind of jokingly say don't do that, but I think you probably want to get away from Windows Media Player. But then again, you're on a Windows machine. Any suggestions for a good streaming audio player on
a
Windows machine
media,
right now?
Oh my gosh.
I've listened to the radio show here just through the browser.
Yeah.
That worked well.
So you just try through the browser plugin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that worked well for me.
Okay.
Yeah, give that a shot, Jerry. I mean, the thing is we don't, I'll definitely take it up. I'll mention that it's that software you're using, Windows Media Player. Thank you so much for the call.
Right.
Take care.
Well, thanks very much.
All right. Bye. I'm glad that people are frustrated they can't hear us in the sense that they do want to hear us.
We do take bug reports on air.
And we take bug reports on air.
Oh, jeez. I'm also very happy that he followed us through thick and thin. That's kind of awesome.
Yeah. Very.
Very flattering.
Well, so let's go ahead and go to Santa Cruz. Britt, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, you know what? I'm saying hi to you, and I'm going to say goodbye because I didn't realize how quickly your machine was stolen. We're running out of time, so
yeah, it was stolen.
I'm so sorry. And it's a MacBook. If you set up the right kind of software, Apple can help you. Apple does have their serial number. You have your serial number. You can definitely report it stolen. I would definitely go to the police and report it stolen. That point, if you haven't set up your machine to be trackable before you get stolen, you're kind of out of luck. But there is software Apple has that you can do before it gets stolen. And it's a good idea to do it, I think.
If you have the time machine.
It's not so good for you. Thank you, Britt, for the call. I'm sorry, I've got to go.
Thanks.
If you do have a machine in your life, you can email us. We'll try to help
you.
Yeah,
I think like the iCloud service actually.
Yeah, it does. It does provide some of that support. Streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Stacey Jurgensen. Yes?
Jurgens.
Thanks. I didn't have it in front of me. And of course, now that I've said goodbye to a person rudely, I realize we have about 40 more seconds of time.
Oh, geez.
So GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. You can learn anything about KOSP up at kosp.org, assuming your laptop wasn't stolen, and anything you'd like about our show at geekspeak.org, including MP3s to download it and links to our podcast so you can make sure to get it delivered to your home every day. 30 seconds, Miles?
And just to leave this with you, the game Magic the Gathering,
yeah,
it turns out it's Turing complete.
Oh my gosh. It's a programming environment now? That's awesome. Alan Turing kind of defined what a computer is, and the machine is a complete Turing machine. It means it's a computer. It can do anything. So Magic the Gathering, awesome. Geekspeak.org, I'm Lyle Troxell.